And good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. You're listening to Financial Survival, brought to you by Discount Gold and Silver Trading. I'm Melody Cederstrom. I'm here with my co-host, Dave Allen, bringing you our opinion and commentary on today's economic and political events for Happy November 1, 2022. Good afternoon, Dave. It's Tuesday.
Hey, it is. Indeed it is. Hello, Melody. Hello, listeners. Happy National Authors Day. More importantly, it's National Family Literacy Day. How about that? Celebrated across America, this day focuses on special activities and events that showcase the importance of family literacy programs. More reasons than ever before for families to read aloud, particularly to their children and grandchildren from a young age. Besides that, reading creates quiet quality family time, it develops early vocabulary and listening skills. So head to your local library today and check out a book that your entire family can read together after dinner.
Well, you know, it's even more important in today's world, especially after the past 2 years where kids were not allowed to go to school, and with reports now showing how they've really failed, how their grade scores are, you know, quite a bit lower than what it was because they lacked that proper schooling for 2 years. So it's even more important now to do things like this with the family and to, you know, help them pull ahead again. And I mean, as I heard today, we're trailing China. So, hey, what else is new in those areas? So anyway, gold didn't trail today. Gold was up $14.70 at $1,649. Silver was up 46 cents at $19.70. Platinum was up 20 at 956. And palladium was up 43 at 1,975. All the white metals were up over 2%. And with the USDX today, I mean, it barely moved. It's still 111.53, just down a few pennies. Crude oil was up $1.78 at 88.31. The paper markets today, the Dow was down 80 points, 32,653. The S&P, 3,856, down 15 points. The NASDAQ, 10,890, down 97 points. And the euro, all is happy in euro world. 10-year yield, still above 4%, but it was down just 0.029 today. Asian markets, they were all positive. Let's see what natural gas is doing. It was down almost 8%, 5.849%. So we'll talk about this a little later on in the program, but I guess all eyes are all on the Fed, expecting, you know, to, you know, raised by three quarters of a point and signal it could slow the pace. That's what everyone is anticipating. We'll talk about that here in a little bit. And, you know, again, I'll say this, if the markets didn't recover, or I'm not going to say recover, if the markets didn't move higher, I don't think he would have, you know, but the markets had that bump, as temporary as it might be. And so, yeah, there's no reason. Actually, as strong as they are showing, he should actually do it a full point. But we have job openings that surged in September despite, you know, the Federal Reserve trying to tighten the labor market that they say is fueling the highest inflation readings in 40 years. Job openings for the month were 10.7 million. Well above the estimate for 9. And again, this all comes from the Bureau of Labor Statistics, job openings and labor turnover survey. And if we shorten that, it's called JOLTS. September total eclipsed August, upwardly revised level, by 500,000. And so, yeah, I don't even think they watch this. They know what they're going to do. So I don't know what type of an impact it really has on their decision making, although they're going to claim it does, you know, a lot. You know, they watch it. You know, it's kind of like watching paint dry, I guess. But, you know, it's not going to do anything to keep the Fed from doing what they're doing in their poor attempt to stem inflation, Dave.
Yeah, well, the data translates into 1.9 job openings for every available worker. That disparity in supply and demand has certainly helped fuel the wage increases, where more recently the employment cost index is growing at about a 5% annual pace. And for the past 2 years, employers have complained they just can't find enough workers. And the past month was certainly more of the same. So many jobs available, you know, workers can afford to resign and seek employment that pays more or offers better or different perks, flexibility like working from home if that's what they choose. And so the company's been forced to raise wages to attract and keep qualified staff. And this higher pay is contributing to this inflation that's hit 40-year highs this year. Now, layoffs dropped in September to 1.3 million, and that's the fewest since April. Not in the direction the Fed, I suspect, would be hoping for, but the number of people quitting their jobs slipped in September to just below 4.1 million, although that is still pretty doggone high by historical standards, Melody.
But, you know, it cracks me up because they say, oh, a company's been forced to raise wages and this is, you know, contributing to inflation. Well, you know, people, their wages are not keeping up with inflation, so how is it contributing to inflation? If it's not keeping up with inflation, how can it add to inflation? You have people going back to work, people that are on fixed incomes picking up part-time jobs just so that they can get by. They're canceling their trips. They're canceling this. So, it's if you're trying to keep up, I don't know how it's adding
how this
to.
System of ours is rigged against the working family. Basically, you know, always has.
What's attributing to inflation is our poor dollar. You know, printing too many of those. It's a monetary policy situation. And this whole system is so messed up that, it's rare that these reports, that they contradict themselves so much in so many different ways. Because here you have the manufacturing is growing at the slowest pace since 2020. 2.5 years in October. The ISM Manufacturing Index posted a 50.2 reading, representing the percent of companies reporting expansion for October. Okay, so now this was a little bit better than what everyone was estimating, like the Dow Jones was estimating. One good news of news from the ISM data, the prices index fell another 5.1% or points to a 46.6 reading, indicating a lessening of inflation pressures. Well, we'll see about that. But as we know, any reading above 50 signals expansion in manufacturing, and it only accounts for 12% of the economy anymore. It used to be a lot bigger number. We were better off when it was a bigger number. But although the overall manufacturing activity fell, the ISM survey forward-looking new orders sub-index, that rose to 49.2 from 47.1 back in September. So, you know, you can look at it. You know, of course, the analysts are going to look at it as some resiliency among consumers out there. But I don't know, Dave. That's still a pretty poor reading.
Very modest, below expectations. You know, when they say a lessening of inflation pressures, I mean, that really is meant to say in the manufacturing industry. I mean, again, overall manufacturing in the U.S. accounting for about 12% of GDP, it's not a a big bang, if you will. These numbers, especially when they're good, are being, shall we say, well, I'm going to say used. I won't say manipulated, but certainly being used and hoped for by investors, especially that, you know, the as a sign that, you know, well, maybe the Fed is not going to be as obsessive about raising rates further. But don't shut your eyes, because tomorrow is coming, and as we'll talk about a little later, I think what comes out of Powell's mouth tomorrow and their post-meeting statement will every bit reflect the expectations we're seeing in the Fed futures market today. In any event, there's some signs in this latest ISM report that some of the supply chain snafus, particularly manufacturing, are perhaps getting a little better. So the measure of supplier deliveries fell to 46.8 from 52.4. The reading below 50 indicates quicker deliveries to factories. And thus they say, well, with supply chains functioning more normally, particularly over time, inflation pressures at factories will continue to recede. So, again, a lot of numbers. I think the big news here is that it's not a huge change that's going to have, I think, any impact on what the Fed essentially has already decided, because Melody, yeah. As I'll say in the third segment today, the fix is in.
Yeah, it is. You know, I mean, they're just going through the motions, and whatever temporary things that it does to make people feel good and so forth will happen. But, you know, and I've been saying it for a long time, and we haven't seen anything yet in the home building market, the housing market. And again, with another interest rate, you know, tomorrow, you know, it's home builders are saying it's just going to get worse come the new year. We continue to see these new orders dry up, and these fast rising mortgage rates, you know, and Dave, you know, people say, well, you know, that's what we paid back in 2000. Yeah, but we had 20 years of easy money. People get used to that. It's the drug, and it's hard to go back to no drug and to see these rates rise, and people make, you know, 20, 30 years commitments on having, you know, low rates and everything. And, you know, so everybody has to change, you know, what they had planned, you know, for their families and, you know, everything else that they're involved in. So, you know, this Gene Myers, he's the CEO of Thrive Home Builders in the Denver area. He says there's this cliff that's happening in January. He said, granted, builders, you know, home builders were a major beneficiary of the COVID economy. Record low interest rates combined with surging demand from consumers looking for more living space caused a run on housing, unlike, you know, most people have not seen before. We saw home prices surge 40% in just 2 years. We saw home builders, they couldn't make these houses or take orders fast enough. Well, they couldn't get the materials in either. That kind of added to the situation. And so we saw housing starts for single family homes drop nearly 19% year over year in September. Building permits, which are an indicator of future construction, fell 17%, Dave.
Well, Pulte, the Pulte Group, you know about them, Melody.
Yeah.
Big in your area. One of the nation's largest home builders reported its cancellation rate jumped from 15% in the second quarter to 24% in the third. That's home buyers backing out of tentative agreements to buy. I mean, the public home builders, publicly traded, that is, that have reported earnings so far, showed surprisingly strong results. That's because most of it's based on a backlog of homes that went under contract last spring. And of course, that was well before mortgage rates crossed the 6 and 7% line. They were under 3 back then. Now, builders are preparing for what's coming down the road. Myers, again, said that thanks to backlog of homes at high prices, the market will be, in his words, ugly by the start of the year. He said any hope of a soft landing really evaporated last spring. So he refers to buyers, customers, as having gone on strike. So it doesn't look good. National Association of Home Builders chief economist Bob Dietz, who we quote roughly once or twice a month, said that this will be the first year, 2023, I believe he's saying, maybe 2022, since 2011, to see a decline for single family starts.
You know, I mean, it just didn't gradually slow down. It did just go off a cliff. And building homes has a big impact because there goes your furniture stores, there goes your appliance stores, there goes, you know, everything else. But builders have to keep building. Someone told me a long time ago, Dave, you know, we often see, we hear reports like this and, you know, how things are slowing down, but yet you see, it's like they continue to build. And it's like, and you can't figure out, well, if things are so bad, why are they continuing to build? And I was told it was because these builders have all these loans with these banks and everything, and they have to build. They can't stop building. They have to continue to build. And
I mean, it's a requirement. It's a condition of most of these loans.
So
building, a high-rise multi-family condominium or single-family housing.
Yeah, they have to continue to build, and you know, to a point where I guess you know, then it, you know, it's goes far beyond saving anything. So, you know, and I don't know, maybe banks plan it that way, but I can remember again, banks don't sit around; they go after the small business people. In difficult times, I've been told stories where one was a baker. The bank said, "I doubt you're going to be able to, you know, pay your loans going through the Great Recession." Fortunately, the banker had attorneys, and they were able to solve the situation and work it out with the bank. But another guy in construction was unable to do the same, and he lost his home. And banks do strange things because they're not going to be losing their money. Only you. So get prepared. 50% of restaurants are unable to pay rent. Almost one half of small restaurant businesses across the country, they can't pay the rent. And this was in October. In September, 36% of restaurants couldn't pay their rent. Oh, I hear music. That means we're heading into a break. We'll be right back. Please stay tuned. You're listening to Financial Survival. $100 condo, $200 rent. I get a check on Friday, but it's already spent. Working for a living. Working for a living. Working for a living. Living and a working. I'm taking what they're giving because I'm working for a living.
Since the beginning of the United States, kings have sought it, nations have fought for it. It has been traded, borrowed, purchased, and stolen. There is a reason for it. To secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity, invest with the security of gold and silver. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading at 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Listen to Financial Survival with your host, Melody Cederstrom, on Shortwave Radio. Visit DiscountGoldAndSilverTrading.net or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. For the very best in gold and silver trading, call toll-free 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Call now.
Melody Cederstrom and CSE Talk Radio team up as Common Sense Voices of Integrity. I personally endorse Melody Cederstrom to be your trusted go-to expert for all your precious metal needs. Experts agree a financial crisis and even collapse is inevitable. Given our government's lack of economic leadership and self-interest of those in power, it's no longer a question of if you should purchase gold and silver, but if you will purchase gold and silver before it's too late. Melody encourages you to tune in each weekday morning. Visit CSE Talk Radio. CSETalkRadio.com. We both agree truth and education are the two significant factors in both our missions. There is a wealth of misinformation out there. Let Melody and Beth Ann help you sort through the chaos and bring you home to the truths that will ensure that you and your family are protected. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading, 1-800-375-4188, or online at DGScoins.com. Melody and Beth Ann are strong forces together, working to preserve liberty and bring America home.
Oh, mercy, mercy,
And welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. You're listening to Financial Survival, brought to you by Discount Gold and Silver Trading, 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Please make sure you visit our website at dgscoins.com, dgscoins.com. Make sure you sign up for our weekly newsletter. And again, patience, folks. The silver market is just, it's just frozen. We're able to lock in prices and things, are just taking a little bit longer, but it's there for you to purchase. It's not to say it's not there. It's just, it's like at the grocery store. If people come in and they buy up all the bread, well, you have to wait until the next deliveries and until that bread is remade to fill up the shelves. So, it's pretty much the same way. So we can lock the prices in for you and keep you posted on when the next deliveries happen. And again, this is just one of the reasons, the freeze in the markets is the end of the year. So there are some things in gold. A lot of your gold products are live. And the gold Britannias, we're even getting 2023s on those. So give us a call, 1-800-375-4188. We're just going to finish up about the 50% of restaurants are unable to pay rent. Rent inflation is expected to remain high in 2023. And is it because the rents are high or higher, or it's just no business, Dave?
Well, that's a good question. It's probably one leads to the other. I mean, it's a combination, I guess, in other words. Fourth quarter of this year, we see that's just 17% of particularly small restaurant owners are planning to hire. Now that's down significantly from 56% last year. But if you step back for a second and think about that, I mean, last year was coming off of 2020. Which was a devastating year when thousands of restaurants went out of business. And so I'm not sure that is a really illuminating figure. We also see that the hours that restaurants are open declined. I mean, 6.4 few hours on average than it was 3 years ago before the pandemic, translating to a decline of 7.5%. So that's one of the reasons I think that small business optimism is, again, below the 48-year average of 98 for the ninth consecutive month.
Yeah, that inflation, it's amazing how it creeps into everything. And I'm sure even the prices, the premiums, we talked about higher premiums on gold and silver yesterday. And I'm sure inflation is part of that increase also, because you do have higher costs in mining. You have higher costs in manufacturing the plants. You have higher costs all along the board. So, everything gets and that's the manufacturing part of the gold coins, not related to the spot at that point in time. So everything gets impacted, and it puts a damper on, how these smaller businesses and so forth can get by. So let's go ahead and talk about United Airlines, because supposedly, Dave, right after the elections, you have the railroads that are going to be going on strike. Because they have yet to reach an agreement by then.
Yeah.
And Now, the airline unions, they're ready to start striking. United Airlines pilots overwhelmingly rejected a tentative agreement that would have given pilot raises of nearly 17%. The Airline Pilots Association said tentative agreement fell short of the industry-leading contract that United pilots have earned and deserve after leading the airline through the pandemic and back to profitability. What would the pilots do? What would they do during the pandemic? They weren't allowed to fly.
Yes, they showed up.
Didn't the airlines get tons of money to pay those pilots through the difficult quote unquote pandemic?
Sure.
You know, and bringing the airlines back, how's that work? Bringing the pilots didn't have anything to do to bring them back to profitability. They started flying again. Jeez. Close to 10,000 of United's roughly 14,000 pilots have participated, 94% voting against the agreement, Dave.
Wow, that's pretty stark. This will be, I think, an interesting test case for not just the airline industry, but for big business in general over the next year. Things as tight as they are now, and with workers at least, not as strongly this year as last, but still feeling their oats and feeling they have more leverage. Delta airline pilots voted to authorize a strike if the airline and union can't come to an agreement. And if you got, United, 10,000, 14,000 pilots, that's a lot of, flights, Melody. And, when customers start seeing pickets at the airports, well, that's certainly going to, I think, contribute to additional division, even if it is after the elections.
Yeah. So you got two unions ready to go striking right after the elections, going into the holiday season and heavy traffic for everything. And so I'm not sure if that's the case, how that's going to, if the supply chains and shortages continue to improve. That'll put a damper on that real quick. And it'll be interesting to see if these two go on strike, who else follows? Because everybody's going to take the lead from one another. And, it's kind of like if you see something hurting and you think you can take advantage of it and say, well, if they're doing it, we're going to, if you're right in the right position to do something, I would think other unions would follow. I don't know. But so I guess we see stresses in the supply chains and shortages of materials continue to dissipate. But tight labor markets, tempered consumer demand, and excess inventories represent still a lot of challenges for producers. That summarizes the latest handful of regional Federal Reserve surveys of manufacturers as the central bank, again, gets ready to raise rates. Product lead times for manufacturers largely improved across the most regional Fed districts. A measure of supplier deliveries for producers covered by the Richmond Fed showed the fastest time since 2009. So that's kind of interesting. 2009, not 2020, but 2009, when the U.S., of course, we know was in a recession at that point in time. Kansas City Fed region, one manufacturer acknowledged that the supply chain was better. Overseas shipments are cheaper and faster. And again, helping reduce prices paid for materials. Well, cheaper and faster, I think that would be cheaper, Dave, because our dollar is stronger, so those imports are making those things cheaper. Is that the way I'm reading it? So it really doesn't have anything to do with, hey, we're going to lower the price, it's our dollar. And
Well, they're saying softer demand, too, is clearing this pipeline that was once overflowing with crates stuffed with you think of it, it was in him. So, I mean, that's sending certainly a mixed message because...
But we can also see a similar thing if China is shutting down areas in their in the country, and if they're not going to be shipping things, and then all of a sudden, oh well, okay, you can go back to work now, and everything gets processed quickly. You're going to see the same thing again, I would think, or something very similar.
But you have Texas, Kansas City, and Philadelphia. Fed districts showing fifth and sixth months of shrinking orders.
Wow.
So I guess that is a sign of lowering demand. And then, of course, there's staffing that some of these shippers are still contending with. So interesting times, that's for sure.
Well, you know, what really hits the pocketbooks and what really, you know, because most everybody can, you know, they don't need a new TV or they don't, you know, they don't need, you know, they can wear the old pair of shoes a little bit longer or something. But when it comes to food and energy, that's where we're really going to see things not change. Global wheat prices, they rose sharply yesterday. And, of course, Russia withdrew from the Black Sea grain export deal over the weekend. I think they still shipped something out even after that deal was pulled, I think I read yesterday. The December wheat contract on the Chicago Board of Trade jumped 5.9% to 8.78 a bushel. The high was 8.93. Corn, soybean prices have also risen, not as much, with corn futures up 1.2%. Soybean 1.3. Wheat and soybeans rebounded almost 2% today, while corn was up about 0.75. So now again, these increases come after Russia announced Saturday that it was going to suspend its involvement in the Black Sea Grain Initiative, and that allowed vital agriculture products to be exported from several of the Ukrainian ports. And of course, they accused Ukraine of the massive drone attack on the Black Sea Fleet in Crimea. So no one really says who was responsible for the attack. And Zelensky just said, you know, it was predictable. So,
yeah, there's a lot of finger pointing going on.
Are you there, Dave? You're gone. We do not hear you. There you are.
I am here.
I heard you for a little bit.
I almost lost my chair. Ukraine's blaming Russia. Russia's blaming U.S., and, you know, meanwhile, you've got is millions of people depending on these wheat shipments, people who are already facing famine in many cases, are on the verge of it, and this certainly doesn't help. I mean... These particular grain shipments apparently were bound for both European and African ports. And it's just not a pretty scene right now.
Yeah. So food and energy, folks, that's where it's going to hit, all us common folk. You know, it's interesting because you hear a lot of these tech companies got hammered in the stock markets lately. You hear Musk is looking to... can 25, 35, 50%, a big jump, a lot of people in Twitter. And so demand for workers in the tech sector is really down sharply from last year. They had gone on a hiring binge. Now they're beginning to tighten their belt. with hiring freezes and even layoffs. The industry's woes could be an early indicator of what's to come in the broader labor market, which has so far stayed strong despite other worrying signs in the economy. So fewer job openings means less demand for workers. And it's also another indicator that folks won't be able to, you know, job hop their way to, you know, some sort of a sky-high pay increase that some of them were able to get in 2021. And that was just a year ago. You could basically name your price. So lower demand means slowing wage growth. Of course, that's what the Fed wants anyway, which, as we say on repeat here at Markets, is, you know, that's what they want. That's already happening. The employment cost index out Friday showed wage growth falling in the third quarter, although it's still pretty high, Dave.
Yeah, it is pretty high. If you've got a lot of your 401k or other retirement monies in technology stocks in particular, hold on. You're in for continued rough rides. Now, interestingly, the five occupations in the industry that saw the biggest declines in demand were in areas where remote work has taken off during the pandemic, including software development, marketing, and math-related roles, data science or analytical stuff. But overall, there's over 25% decline in human resource job listings. So one guy, Nick Bunker of Indeed, says it probably means you're looking to hire few people in general if you're looking to hire fewer HR people. Overall job listings down 9% on Indeed this year. They're still 50% higher than pre-pandemic levels.
Well, you know, everybody's talking about the food crisis, the energy crisis now. It could pale in comparison to 2023. You know, we've seen this global economy, you know, is, you know, being hit from a few sides, shortages of oil, gas, food, inflation. Concerns are centered on the coming winter, especially for Europe. But as much as there is ahead of this winter, it's really the winter of 2023 and 24 that maybe people should be thinking about and maybe worried about. And we're going to have to be worried about it until tomorrow because we're heading into our break. Well, maybe Dave can touch on it when we get back. Please stay tuned. You're listening to Financial Survival.
Since the beginning of the United States, kings have sought it, nations have fought for it. It has been traded, borrowed, purchased, and stolen. There is a reason for it. To secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity, invest with the security of gold and silver. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading at 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Listen to Financial Survival with your host, Melody Cederstrom, on Shortwave Radio. Visit DiscountGoldAndSilverTrading.net or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. For the very best in gold and silver trading, call toll-free 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Call now.
Melody Cederstrom and CSE Talk Radio team up as Common Sense Voices of Integrity. I personally endorse Melody Cederstrom to be your trusted go-to expert for all your precious metal needs. Experts agree a financial crisis and even collapse is inevitable. Given our government's lack of economic leadership and self-interests of those in power, it's no longer a question of if you should purchase gold and silver, but if you will purchase gold and silver before it's too late. Melody encourages you to tune in each weekday morning. Visit CSE Talk Radio. CSETalkRadio.com. We both agree truth and education are the two significant factors in both our missions. There is a wealth of misinformation out there. Let Melody and Beth Ann help you sort through the chaos and bring you home to the truths that will ensure that you and your family are protected. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading, 1-800-375-4188, or online at DGScoins.com. Melody and Beth Ann are strong forces together, working to preserve liberty and bring America home.
And one more time today, welcome back to Financial Survival. I'm Dave Allen, Melody taking care of other client businesses. Final segment, you know where you can get her, 1-800-375-4188. Sorry, I should have apologized up front. Dealing with a nagging sinus condition the past couple days, so sorry if I'm sounding unusually nasal. Hopefully it'll be gone soon enough. Now, I don't know about you, but I'm telling you, the more I read about these record quarterly profits, especially from big oil companies, the more my anger is rising. One of them, Saudi Aramco, today reported a $42.4 billion profit in the third quarter. The 39% bump, buoyed by higher global energy prices that have filled the kingdom's coffers at our expense and has helped fuel inflation around the world. The oil firm's profits are certainly going to help fund aggressive Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman's plans for a futuristic city on the Red Sea coast. But it also comes as the U.S. grows increasingly frustrated by higher prices at the pump, chewing into American consumers' wallets. Those tensions yet again have chilled relations between Riyadh and Washington before next Tuesday's elections. In a note to investors, the predominantly state-owned Saudi Arabian oil company said its average barrel of crude sold for about $102 in the third quarter, up from roughly 73 at the same point a year earlier. It's Aramco's second largest quarterly profit in its history. Just before its second quarter results this year saw a profit of $48 billion, ladies and gentlemen. But its profit so far in 2022 at $130+ billion, compared to just $77.6 billion in 2021, gosh, it pales in comparison to that $30 billion it made in the third quarter last year. Aramco says it will keep its dividend this quarter at just about $19 billion, the world's highest. No word yet on stock buybacks. The sliver of Aramco that the kingdom has put on Riyadh's Tadawul stock market stood at $9.29 a share this morning, put its valuation at just over $2 trillion. Only Apple's valuation at $2.44 trillion is higher. Saudi Arabia's vast oil resources, located close to the surface of its desert, make it one of the world's cheapest places to produce crude. For every $10 rise in the price of a barrel of oil, Saudi Arabia stands to make an additional $40 billion a year, according to the Institute of International Finance. Now, that again, that's crucial, as Prince Mohammed and his father, King Salman, rely on oil revenues to fund the kingdom's government and new projects like the LIV Golf Tour. The International Monetary Fund puts Saudi Arabia's break-even price for crude at just under $80 a barrel. They've been doing well. Prince also wants to
use the high oil prices to help fund his planned $500 billion futuristic city called Neom on the Red Sea. Now we know OPEC and its loose confederation of other countries, led by Russia, agreed in early October to cut its production by 2 million barrels a day, actually beginning today. OPEC, led by Saudi Arabia, has insisted its decision is the result of concerns about the global economy and not any geopolitics. Whatever the case in Washington, anger has grown with the Saudis, particularly from President Biden, who traveled to the kingdom in July and shared a fist bump with Crown Prince Mohammed. That's even after he called the kingdom a pariah over Saudi security forces executing and dismembering Washington Post columnist Jamal Khashoggi in 2018. And of course, that's a slang that American intelligence agencies believe came at the Crown Prince's orders. Now, Biden recently warned that the kingdom, that there's going to be some consequences for what they've done. This gallon of regular gas here now costs, on average, $3.75. That seems low. Gasoline prices often rank among the top concerns for American voters. Yesterday, Biden separately accused oil companies of war profiteering as he raised the possibility of imposing a windfall tax on the energy companies if they don't boost domestic productions. Now, there's something I believe we can get behind. The president's description of the record profits posted by energy companies in recent weeks as war profiteering represents a noticeable uptick in rhetoric from the White House. While U.S. companies arguably have the ability to raise oil and gas production, they've been relatively slow to respond to surging prices over the past several months. Instead, they focus on capital discipline, that is, not overspending to boost production and returning cash to shareholders in the form of dividends and stock buybacks. Excuse me, take BP, for example, which increased its dividend by 10% in the second quarter. And they're going to buy back $2.5 billion in shares after repurchasing $7.6 billion already this year. BP's committed to using 60% of its excess cash flow for shareholder returns. That's just outrageous. Top five Western oil and gas companies paid out a record $29 billion in share buybacks and dividends in the third quarter. According to Reuters, BP said it expects to pay about $2.5 billion in taxes on its British North Sea business this year, including $800 million in a 25% windfall tax government imposed in May. Even Macy, my new puppy, is unhappy about that, as you could probably hear her in the background. Now, in today's Wall Street on Parade, Pam and Russ Martin's write about federal prosecutors asking a federal court recently to dismiss a criminal indictment against Tom Hayes. Hayes, you may know, is a former Wall Street trader charged by the Justice Department with rigging the interest rate benchmark known as LIBOR. Melody and I have talked about over the years. The federal prosecutors say they had no choice but to ask for the dismissal of the case because 380-some-year-old federal judges on the Second Circuit Appellate Court ruled that it wasn't really illegal at all. That's despite successful jury trials on the LIBOR issue, convictions, and billions of dollars in fines paid by the banks for their illegal LIBOR activity. The Martins say the Hayes case is a textbook example of how to bring a market-rigging case. They report that the Justice Department prosecutors had reams of chat room messages where Hayes requested other traders to move LIBOR in a specific direction in order to make profits for himself and UBS, the global megabank where he worked. That unit of UBS, the UBS Japan, that is, pled guilty to felony wire fraud
and admitted its role in manipulating LIBOR. UBS paid more than $1.5 billion to settle the charges in the U.S., the U.K., and Switzerland. As the Martins point out, UBS is represented by a sea of lawyers from the most prestigious law firms around the country. They ask, does anyone really think it paid $1.5 billion when its traders did nothing wrong? Well, if you want to read some of the transcripts the Justice Department put out of these chat room messages, which show the market rigging in real time, check out today's Wall Street on Parade newsletter. Crazy, crazy stuff. Now, as you were handing out candy last night, or maybe apples, or walking ghostly neighborhoods among the Nemos, Princess Ariels, and ETs, the ghouls and goblins in Washington were scheming. In fact, the fix is in for another 75 basis point hike in the Fed funds interest rate, that is. Oh, the horror of it all. Now, even though 11% of Fed future traders believe the Fed will raise its target rate by a mere 50 basis points tomorrow, a forced straight increase of 75 basis points is locked in. The Federal Reserve just can't help itself. But Courtney Brown and Neil Irwin at Axios say the more important thing to watch is what Fed head Jerome Powell says at his post-meeting presser about what comes next. They add that Powell and company face a delicate balance between signaling to Wall Street on the one hand that they will eventually slow down to a more cautious pace of tightening without appearing to no longer being as committed to bringing down inflation on the other. It's a balancing act. They just can't win, ladies and gentlemen. I agree with Brown, Irwin, and others who believe the Fed has to slow down its rate campaign eventually. It's already probably pushed the economy down a path that's going to end in a significant recession within the next two quarters. Thus, how Powell delivers the Fed message on Wednesday afternoon is loaded with potential consequences, given how the markets have rallied at any suggestion of a turn in policy in recent months. In fact, Brown and Irwin say the mere possibility that the Fed will slow down and raise rates only 0.5% in December could fuel a stock and bond market surge. And that would have the opposite effect of the tighter financial conditions that the Fed wants to see. So, high-frequency computer algorithms, beware. It's the classic perception is reality conundrum. Indeed, if the public simply perceives that the Fed's commitment to bringing inflation under control is at 100%, its credibility will be hurt further. Brown and Irwin point out that the case for slowing down rests on the idea that monetary policy works with long lags, so the cumulative rate hikes already enacted since March has only started to slow down GDP growth. Fed officials say they don't like further burdening the economy about, how about consumers and businesses? In any event, with more 75 basis points hikes when they don't yet know the full extent their actions to date have had. So why do anything? Here's a simple idea. Why don't they just take no action at all on Wednesday and leave rates alone for a month? Just hold on for another four-week cycle of metrics. Jobless claims, jobs added, inflation, consumer spending, layoffs, so forth. In short, wait, do nothing, nada. That in itself is doing something. Leaving rates as they are until they meet again. Just sit back and see what happens. In the bond market, with equities and precious metals, with mortgage rates, currencies, and the like. As Brown and Irwin astutely observe, the Fed and the markets have been stuck in a feedback loop now for months, even longer if you count the months last year when the Fed should have started to tighten. They remind us that investors interpreted Powell's July press conference as signaling that the tightening would end soon, and markets soared as a result. Then, a month later, Powell pushed back somewhat on that theme, and markets took a nosedive, fueling wider concern about a possible global recession. Was that the cause of other global central banks slowing their rate hikes? Bank of Canada approved the smaller than expected hike last week, and European Central Bank is suddenly less hawkish on future rates there, rate hikes. Alas, Powell will likely use tomorrow's press conference following the 75 basis point hike to once again assure markets that the Fed's anti-inflation resolve is strong, while being flexible enough to adapt to changing data in the months ahead. Forget trick or treat, then. We're just going to have to wait for an early Christmas present at the Fed's December meeting. As Vincent Price would say, and that is all the time we have for today's program. I'll return on Thursday. Butch here tomorrow. Wendy Wilson of Apothecary Herbs will be joining him. I'm Dave Allen. Thanks, as always, to our producer, Todd, and to you, our loyal listeners, for tuning into Financial Survival. Please be safe out there. Don't eat too much of your kids' candy. Have a good evening. Bye-bye.
I work all night, I work all day to pay the bills I have to pay. Still, there never seems to be a single penny left for me.
That's too bad.